Burp. Then why the letters with their increasing hopelessness? Why the pitiful sheet of paper showing that he had poured his last $4,700 into a worthless hole in the ground, and his hopes and his life with them? But Planet? Make up his mind to shoot that woman and then himself? Do it coldly and deliberately? Beau Mason, who believed in tomorrow as he believed in himself, deliberately scheme to commit murder and suicide on a tomorrow? That called for a cold-bloodedness, a calculation he had never possessed. Revenge? Self-pity? Despair? If he could once convince himself about how it had happened, he could believe it. He knew it was true. He was on his way to bury his father, but he still couldn't believe that last violence. Somehow he had always thought that violence stopped short of finalities for the old man. It had always been at least part show, for an effect, to compel obedience or bully someone down. There was no point in bullying if you were going to die immediately. There was a desperation in this last act that would probably never be quite credible. The afternoon waned ahead of him down the long, straight road, moving faster than he moved, flattening, sinking, going dusky. Sky and earth were a bowl over a disk, then two planes, the upper lighter than the lower, between which he moved. He turned on his lights and unwrapped the sandwich he had bought the last time he stopped for gas. This, too, was familiar. The feel of the car's motion, oil smell and night smell, the sweet, muffled roar of the motor, the phantasmagoria of half-seen shadows, trees, buildings, outside the running headlights. It was old and familiar and even comfortable, and all he had to do was keep the hard, hot accelerator button under his foot, keep the white center line of the highway just off his left front wheel. The dawn, too, would be familiar, the slow lightening of the sky until the two planes became again disk and bowl, the windless pale light, just barely not darkness, the horses standing in the pastures, the cars cutting along the road with lights still on, the clatter and smoke of the Los Angeles Limited coming behind him, catching him, passing him, the shades down on the dark Pullmans, the observation car with windows palely alight, an early rising passenger on the rear platform, watching the vanishing point of steel. It was all familiar. It seemed to him, yawning, scratchy-eyed, that there was the whole rhythm of his life in it, that all through his remembered life the days had gone under him like miles, that he and his whole family had always been moving on toward something that was hidden beyond where the road bent between the hills. As he shifted to ease his aching back, he thought of the old man, always chasing something down a long road, always moving on from something to something else. At the very end, before that fatal morning, he must have looked down his road and seen nothing. No Big Rock Candy Mountain, no lemonade springs, no cigarette trees, no little streams of alcohol, no handout bushes. Nothing. The end. The empty end. Nothing to move toward, because nothing was there. He began to see dimly why his father had shot himself, and half to believe that he had.
"You can't go down there now," Joe said. "You haven't had any sleep in 2 days. Let it wait till morning."
"I'd better go," Bruce said. "I don't think I could sleep anyway till I did." He looked at the clock in the kitchen and yawned so wide he couldn't see the hands. Joe, watching him from across the table, pulled the corners of his mouth down.
"I feel all right," Bruce said. "I'd better get it over."
It was only 9:40. A bath had helped. The clean shirt and underclothes and socks borrowed from Joe had helped. He could stay awake another hour or two, and until he got down to that hotel and got a few things straight, he wasn't going to be comfortable. Beside him on the porcelain top of the kitchen table was yesterday's paper, the front page with a two-column story and a picture of Elaine Nesbitt holding the leash on a straining bulldog. "S.L. Mining Man Kills Woman, Self," the headline said. He read the story through again, trying to get that how straight in his mind, but what the newspaper said didn't help much. Harry Mason, local mining man, had met Elaine Nesbitt in the lobby of the Winston Hotel at 9 in the morning. They had quarreled some time previously over mining interests in which both were interested, according to James Dobson, the hotel clerk. They quarreled again in the lobby, and Mrs. Nesbitt, pretty auburn-haired widow, struck Mason with her handbag and ran out toward the side entrance. Mason jerked a gun from his coat pocket and followed. Dobson, trying to grapple with him, was thrown against the desk. He heard the outside door slam, then 2 shots. When he got to the door, Mason was slumped against the radiator with a bullet through his head. He was still breathing, but died within 10 minutes. There was a bullet hole through the door, and outside, Mrs. Nesbitt lay face down, shot through the heart. So it was rage, blind, berserk fury. But he read on, and it wasn't so clear. According to Desk Sergeant Walter Hill, Mason had come in 3 days previously to get a permit to carry a gun. He had mining interests in Nevada and was accustomed to carry considerable sums on his person. In granting the permit, the sergeant had asked him if he had any criminal record, a routine question, and Mason had said jokingly, "Not yet." At the time, he had seemed calm. "I've just got to go down there," Bruce said. "It shouldn't take more than an hour or two." "Want me to go along?" Joe said. "You're already mixed up in this enough." "That's all right," Joe said. "I'd be glad to come along if you want." Bruce shook his head, tore the story out of the newspaper, and folded it into his pocket. He remembered the hotel, a dark little semi-respectable place on First South. The lighted shelf above the entrance looked dingy, and the door opened hard. There was no one in the lobby except the clerk behind the desk. Bruce's eyes darted past the desk, spotted the hall leading to the side entrance, and the radiator's dull gilt gleaming in the desk light. He locked his insides as if he were trying not to vomit. "I'm Bruce Mason," he said to the clerk. "I just got in." The clerk had a cast in one eye. The other one jumped, startled, in his pale face. He came out from behind the desk, hurrying. "Oh, yeah," he said. "I'll get Dobson. He was on when—" "Just wait here a minute." He ran up the stairs 2 at a time, and Bruce stood still by the desk. In this dingy little lobby, yesterday morning, the thing had been done. He moved toward the side entrance. The carpet down the little hall had been taken up, and he saw the unpainted boards and the splintered tack holes. Against this radiator, within reach of his hand, his father had stood, in what desperate frenzy, and spattered his brains against this wall. He shut his jaw and turned away, and as he turned, he saw the bullet hole in the panel of the door. Steps were coming, and he went back to the desk. A short man with a bald spot came down and shook his hand. "I've been expecting you," he said. "Your dad left some papers and things. Want to look at them now?"
"I might as well."
The little man looked at him sidelong.
"It's a hell of a thing," he said. "You seen the papers? You know how it happened?"
"Let it go," Bruce said. "I've seen the paper." For all his need to settle the tiniest detail, the facial expression even of that last furious minute of his father's life, he did not want to talk to the clerk. It had to come without any coloring. But the lobby had told him nothing. The radiator was a radiator, nothing more. And even the stains of his father's blood on it, if there had been any, would not have made this thing any more believable.
"I never had any idea he was feeling that way," Dobson said as they went upstairs. "Oh, I knew he was having a little trouble about money, and he'd had a spat or two with Elaine, but Jesus!"
He turned down the hall, unlocked the door of a room.
"The cops told me to keep it locked," he said, "but you can go in."
Bruce stood half in the door. "Would you mind," he said, "could I look things over alone?"
"Sure," Dobson hesitated. "I don't want to push or anything, but Harry owed me $20. If he had any insurance or anything, I wonder—"
"I'll fix it up," Bruce said. "Did he owe anything else, do you know?"
"I know he owed something to O'Brien from the Cantwell Hotel.
O'Brien came around here trying to collect once or twice. I think he owes some rent here, too.
Well, I'll go through things and see what's here, Bruce said.
And he owed for a suit of clothes, Dobson said. It wasn't hardly cold before that Jew Miller was calling up, wanting to know where he was going to get his money.
Where's the suit?
He was wearing it.
All right, Bruce said. He closed the door and looked around. The bed was made, the closet door open. Inside the closet there was a suit and a pair of black shoes and a bundle of neckties, several of which had apparently never been worn. On the dresser, under a silver shaving mug, was a large envelope addressed to Bruce Mason. Then he had known he was going to do it. It hadn't been done in a rage. The letters and the worthless stock certificate were not blackmail or begging. As he sat down on the bed with the heavy envelope in his hand, he felt as if he were going to be sick. The envelope contained an insurance policy for $500 and a receipt book showing that his father had made monthly payments, the last one on June 1st. Clipped together, there were 5 pawn tickets with penciled scribblings on the backs. The tickets said, overcoat, suitcase, watch, suitcase, suitcase. There was a map with red markings in the corner, showing the location of the Della mine. There were the 3 letters that Bruce had written during the last 2 months in answer to his father's. His own handwriting looked incongruous and strange to him now, seen as his father had seen it.
"And what about the letters?" he said. "Nothing in them but little bread-and-butter checks and a lot of smug, free advice. Take a brace, keep your chin up, you're not licked yet. Why not get a job at something, any kind of job, till you get a stake again, instead of waiting and depending on this mine?"
He held the 3 letters in his hand, hating himself. The last thing he looked at was a certificate of ownership for the cemetery lot, together with a sexton's receipt and another receipt showing that perpetual care had been bought and paid for. He sat on the bed weighing the papers in his hands. No note. The letter written on June 1st was the last. He had known that long before that there wasn't anything left. The shaving mug on the dresser caught his eye, and he reached to lift it down. The metal was tarnished. One side was dented. The inscription on the side was worn almost away, but he held it up to the light and read it. Champion of North Dakota, Single Traps, Harry Mason, 1905. That was the final sum, the final outcome, of the skill and talents and strength his father had started with. One dented silver mug, almost 30 years old. One pair of worn shoes, one worn suit, a dozen spotted neckties, a third interest in a worthless mine, a cemetery lot with perpetual care, a few pawn tickets, a few debts, a few papers, an insurance policy to bury him, and a cemetery lot to bury him in. That last small resource, hoarded jealously, even while the larger and hopeful resources were squandered. Quietly he set the mug down, folded pawn tickets and papers into the envelope, and stood up, thinking of the radiator downstairs, the little hall with the carpet taken up, the door with the bullet hole. His father had wasted himself in 1,000 ways, but he had never been an incompetent. Even in that last despair, that last shattered minute when rage led him to include the woman in his plan of death, he had done a workmanlike job. He killed the woman with one shot through the door, and he killed himself cleanly with another. There were so many things the old man could do a good job on. He had had a knack for versifying and storytelling. He was a dead shot with any kind of gun. He could take an automobile apart and put it back together in the dark. He was a carpenter, a cabinet maker. He was strong as a bull, stubborn as a mule, single-minded as a monk. And all of that, wasted in the wrong causes, all of that coming to its climax with a neat and workmanlike job of murder and suicide.
There was a light knock on the door, and he swung around, stuffing the papers into his coat as if he had stolen them. A tall and very thin woman stood there, looking at him with a soft, almost dewy expression in her eyes. Her mouth twitched.
"You're his son," she said. "I heard you were here," she said. "I had to come and see you. I'm Mrs. Winter. I live just down the hall."
"I see," he said, wondering what she had to do with it, where she came in. Another of his father's women?
"You look like your picture," Mrs. Winter said. "He showed it to me once."
"You mean he had a picture of me?"
"In his wallet."
That shamed him, too. The man he had hated all his life carried a picture around in his wallet, showed it to people, perhaps with pride. Everything in this bare, cheap little room shamed him. "Did you see much of him before?" he said. She had started to cry without noise.
"He was just desperate," she said. "He told me a month ago he was going to do it, and he was so violent and hard you couldn't come near him. He told me a couple of weeks ago he was going to do it the next day."
"What stopped him then?" Bruce said. His imagination was on ahead of her, seeing the despair and hopelessness and desperation coming face to face with the final violence and shying away, weakening.
"I don't know," she said. "I did what I could. I got a friend of mine with a car, and we all went out to the lake and drove around all afternoon, and I talked to him. I told him he'd get back on his feet, but he just looked out the window and gritted his teeth. I kept him up as late as I could that night, but when he left, I was scared to death. Then I saw him the next morning, and I was so relieved."
"Yes," Bruce said.
"I thought he was all over it," Mrs. Winter said. "The last 3 or 4 days before it happened, he was just as sweet, just as gentle and smiling. You'd have thought all his troubles had been settled. And all the time he had that gun he'd got the permit for."
"I guess," Bruce said, "that nobody could have done anything to stop him. You were good to try."
"I liked him," Mrs. Winter said. "He was honest."
"Honest?" Bruce said. "Honest?" Well, maybe with everyone but himself. He could cheat himself and fool himself and justify himself every time. "But those last few days," he said, "those 3 or 4 days when he went around quiet and smiling and gentle with the pawn shop gun in his pocket?" He was honest with himself then, for perhaps the first and last time. Everything was over for him then. Even the last act then must have seemed unimportant. He put out his hand to Mrs. Winter. "Thank you for being his friend," he said. "I guess he didn't have many at the last."
"Everybody turns against you when you're down," she said. "I know."
With her face bent, she went with short, quick steps down the hall and turned in a door. And there was one version. Harry Mason, that old lush who hung around the Winston lobby and sponged meals and $5 loans from anybody he could collar, that old broken-down big shot who still dreamed of fantastic wealth out of a Nevada gold mine, was, to one woman at least, an honest man, a kind man, a misunderstood man, an unhappy man. "Oh, most certainly an unhappy man," he said, and stood in the open door of his father's room with the tears hot and sudden in his eyes, thinking of that picture in the wallet and of those 3 or 4 days when he was kind and gentle and smiling with a gun in his pocket. At 11:30 he fell into bed at Joe's and lay sleepless for hours, his eyes burning up into the darkness, and his hands and feet feeling immense, swollen, elephantine from the quarts of coffee he had drunk on the road. He threshed it all through and cried hard, racking sobs into the dark, and when he finally fell asleep, he slept until noon. Then there was the undertaker to see, and the discovery, this third time he had used him, that the undertaker was an old whiskey customer of his father's. He laid out the things taken from Beau Mason's clothes, a wallet with $5 in it, a handful of change, an address book, some keys, a couple of pencils, and talked sadly and thoughtfully, drumming with his fingertips on the desk. He had seen Harry around occasionally. No idea he was hard up or in trouble. It was a terrible and mysterious thing. Couldn't have been money only, because Harry had plenty of friends who would have been glad to see him through a bad spot. He'd have given him a loan himself if he'd known. He was full of friendship and sympathy and careful avoidances. He made no effort to sell Bruce an expensive casket. He loaned him a car to run errands in. Bruce wanted to despise him for his profession and his careful talk, but he couldn't despise him. He was too genuinely helpful. While he was talking in the office, a woman came into the hushed parlor and through the door, in a tearful whisper, asked if she could see Mr. Mason, asking as if she expected not to be allowed to. She looked at Bruce once, then ignored him, but as she was starting down the hall, she turned to look again, stared steadily with an anguished pucker between her eyes. Her face was vaguely familiar.
"Aren't you,"
she said, coming back a few steps.
"You aren't Bruce?"
"Yes." In an instant she was in his arms, hanging on to him, sobbing, her ravaged and repaired face close to his, crying out that it was terrible. Oh, my God, it was terrible. Why did he do it? Why did he ever get mixed up with that woman? Oh, my God, she couldn't believe it. She would have come to him. She would have left her family and everything else and had told him so. But not while Elsa was alive. She wouldn't have hurt Elsa for anything in the world. But she could have kept him from that woman. And, my God, Bruce, she wished she had. She wished she had. Leaning back a little, Bruce said, "Yes, and no, and yes. She mustn't take it so hard. There was nothing anyone could do now. Nobody was to blame." She clung to him for a little while, got control of her babbling and her tears, wiped her eyes, blew her nose, looked at him yearningly, and finally went down the hall. And he never did find out who she was, or where he had known her, or what connection there had ever been between her and his father. Next there was the insurance man, Hammond. He, too, shook Bruce's hand, asked him about his studies, wanted to know where he was going to hang up his shingle. He, too, kept his face closed and his mouth discreet, looked up the policy and found that $60 had been borrowed on it. That would have to be deducted from the claim.
"I got Harry this policy after he got sick a couple years ago," he said. "Pretty hard to get it through the office. He wasn't well. He wasn't well at all. Had some kind of stroke, blood pressure way up."
He filled in blanks and asked questions, shook his head as he waited for the ink to dry. Words of condolence, of sympathy, were on the tip of his tongue, and Bruce knew it. The man might even be grieved at Beau Mason's death, but it was not a death you could talk about. All Hammond could say was,
"Yes, sir, I've known Harry for almost 15 years.
That seemed to express what it was possible to express under the circumstances. He repeated it when he shook Bruce's hand in farewell and assured him that the policy would come right through, 2 weeks or so at the most. A graying and not too prosperous businessman, he stood shaking Bruce's hand thoughtfully, saying, "Yes, sir, he'd known Harry for 15 years. Not, Bruce thought angrily on his way out, "Yes, sir, Harry was a swell guy, one of the best. His death is a loss." Not that. Not even, "Yes, sir, Harry and I have been friends for 15 years. It took courage to say to the son of a murderer and suicide that you liked him, that he was your friend. It took courage even to talk about the manner of his death. The best you could say was, "Damn them," he said. "If they can't say anything good about him, why don't they keep their mouths shut?" The minister who said the few ritual words in the funeral parlor was obviously embarrassed. He clearly found it difficult to say much over the body of one who had lived and died by violence, and though he was bound to ask God's grace on this poor sinner, he did it only with half a heart, and spent most of his 10 minutes on the afflictions that are visited upon mankind, the trials that come in life, the unhappiness that burdens us from the cradle to the grave. Man is born to sorrow as the sparks fly upward. This little family, for instance, had been grievously stricken. Within 3 years the mother, the son, and now the father had been struck down. He prayed that God's mercy would be with them all, and with the young man who survived. As he halted on, avoiding direct reference to Beau Mason, making solemn generalities in the solemn padded parlor, talking about a man he had not known, and lamenting for a family he had never heard of until today, Bruce could feel him all the way wanting to make the body of this Beau Mason the subject of a sermon on the wages of sin, holding back because the offices he was conducting prohibited any ill-speaking of the dead. And so, morally indignant and yet unable to speak his mind, limping through his solemn and meaningless 10 minutes. As he talked, Bruce's mind worked in ironic counterpoint. This man, whom today we consign to the grave, this Harry Mason, was a man whom I and many others have condemned. We have sat in judgment on him, and we have found him guilty of violence, brutality, willfulness. He was frequently inconsiderate of others. He was obtuse about other people's wishes. He was a man who never knew himself, who was never satisfied, who was born disliking the present and believing in the future. He was not, by any orthodox standard, a good husband or a good father. He chafed against domestic restraints, ruled by violence instead of love, forced his wife and children to live a life they despised and hated. He broke the law, he blasphemed, he served mammon. He was completely incapable of anything remotely resembling social responsibility, and with dedicated selfishness he went after the big money. He wore out his wife and broke her heart. He destroyed one son and turned the other against him. At the end he degenerated into a broken old man, sponging a bare living and sustaining himself on a last gilded and impossible dream. And when he could no longer bear the indignities which the world heaped upon him, and when the dream broke like a bubble, he sought some way, out of an obscure and passionate compulsion to exonerate himself, to lay the blame onto another, the woman who had been his mistress. He shot her, and then turned the gun upon himself, thus ending his life appropriately and fittingly in violence. God may have mercy on this Harry Mason, but he may also wreak justice. God's will be done. Yet this Harry Mason, violent and brutal and unthinking, this lawbreaker and blasphemer, kept for over a quarter of a century the love of as good a woman as ever walked, my mother. And when he appeared to abandon her just before her death, he did so because the prospect of her death was intolerable to him, because in spite of his bullying and self-willed spirit, he loved and cherished her, and he knew that the best of himself would die when she died. This same father, who broke the spirit and spoiled the chances of his older son, took a very great pride in that son's exploits, had dreams for him as golden as his dreams for himself, shook with nightmares for months after that son died. This same father who turned his second son into an animate, cold hatred, carried a photograph of that son in his wallet to the morning of his death. This same selfish fortune hunter was so little cold and calculating that in his last years he was a sucker for the really calculating, the women and promoters who drained off his money and left him sick and broke in a second-rate hotel. This Harry Mason, this antisocial monster, could be nobly generous on occasion, could be affectionate, could weep like a child. It is of that child that we should be talking and thinking while we sit here in judgment over the body of Harry Mason, that child with a quick mind and talented hands, a child off on the wrong foot and unable to see that he was wrong, a child with tremendous self-reliance and tremendous energy and a tremendous drive toward the things that seemed to him good. If he went wrong, he was mistaken, not vicious. Or if vicious, his viciousness was merely the product of the balking of his will. And let us remember that at the end, he did not run or try to hide from himself. He saw himself for a little while, honestly, and only the last minute of rage which led him to kill the woman too prevented his death from being a thing almost humble, as it was. He saw, near at hand, two people who had wronged and betrayed and disgraced him. And as his last act, he killed them both. Harry Mason was a child and a man. Whatever he did, any time, he was a completely masculine being, and almost always he was a child, even in his rages. In an earlier time, under other circumstances, he might have become something the nation would have elected to honor, but he would have been no different. He would always have been an undeveloped human being, an immature social animal, and the further the nation goes, the less room there is for that kind of man. Harry Mason lived with the woman who was my mother, and whom I honor for her kindness and gentleness and courage and wisdom. But I tell you, at his funeral, and in spite of the hatred I have had for him for many years, that he was more talented and more versatile and more energetic than she. Refine her qualities, and you would get saintliness, but never greatness. His qualities were the raw material for a notable man. Though I have hated him, and though I neither honor nor respect him now, I cannot deny him that. Into the grave, into Lot 6, Block 37, beside Elsa Mason and Chester Mason, and let the bodies of the united family unite more intimately in the deep earth than they ever did in life. There is the makings of a man in that family, and more of it than I ever thought will have to come out of the tissues of my father. The preacher stopped. Bruce had not heard him for several minutes. Now he saw him fold his hands and bend his head. From the pews behind, where a sprinkling of acquaintances, nondescript pallbearers recruited from his father's old intimates, banker and broker and bootlegger and pimp, sat and listened to the preacher's words, there came a light sniffle. The attendants came to the edge of the curtains and stood ready. The minister finished his short prayer. The chapel organ began to cough and mourn. Dry-eyed, Bruce stood up and stepped three steps forward to where the coffin lay open. He had not yet brought himself to look at his father's body. The heavy, square hands were crossed on the neatly pressed coat front. The thinning hair was brushed back, and the right temple, where the bullet had entered, was so smoothly patched with wax that only a knowing eye could have detected it. The mouth was gentle, almost humorously curved. The jaw was blunt and strong. Whatever violence had been in the face had been erased. But what he noticed most strongly before the attendants stepped forward and lowered the lid of the casket was the enormous, powerful arch of his father's chest and the width of the shoulders in the satin-lined box. As he followed the handful of people out through the entrance into the sun of the court, he could feel no grief for his father, nor for his mother and brother, whose graves were grassy beside the new, raw hole at the cemetery. He could think only of the brightness of the sun, an excessive, sparkling brightness, as if there were some meaning in it, or a blessing. And he saw the sweep of the spring-green slopes up to the worn peaks above Dry Canyon. His past was upon him, the feeling he had had two or three times that he bore his whole family's history in his own mind, and he remembered the time when he had gone with his mother and father on a picnic to the Bearpaw Mountains, the wonder and delight of his childhood, and the shadow behind it of the things that his mind had caught from infancy, from other times, from some dim remoteness that gave up its meaning slowly and incompletely. He remembered the great snake his father had killed by the roadside, and the gopher that had come slimy and stretched from the snake's mouth, and the feeling he had had then was like the feeling he had now. It was a good thing to have been along and seen, a thing to be remembered and told about, a thing that he and his father shared. Perhaps that was what it meant, all of it. It was good to have been along and to have shared it. There were things he had learned that could not be taken away from him. Perhaps it took several generations to make a man. Perhaps it took several combinations and recreations of his mother's gentleness and resilience, his father's enormous energy and appetite for the new, a subtle blending of masculine and feminine, selfish and selfless, stubborn and yielding, before a proper man could be fashioned. He was the only one left to fulfill that contract and try to justify the labor and the harshness and the mistakes of his parents' lives. And that responsibility was so clearly his, was so great an obligation, that it made unimportant and unreal the sight of the motley collection of pallbearers staggering under the weight of his father's body and the back door of the hearse closing quietly upon the casket and the flowers. This concludes the reading of The Big Rock Candy Mountain by Wallace Stegner. Copyright 1938, 1940, 1942, 1943 by Wallace Stegner. This book was read by Mark Bramhall. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Brandt and Hockman Literary Agents, Incorporated, and was produced in 2010 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.